Hello, America, and to all of our listeners all over the world. You're listening to yet another exciting edition of Let's Weekend. I'm your host for the most, Brandon Perkins. Joining me as always is Chris Logi. Say hi to the people, Chris.
Hello.
Yeah, it's going to be another two-person show again this week. Hopefully it'll be the last for the rest of this year. It's kind of in the middle of that time of the year where stuff like band season is wrapping up and, you know, the fall and winter and all that stuff. And, you know, plans are happening and afoot, and things are finally coming to a halt for this year. So, Teresa will be back with us next week. But don't worry, because we certainly do have a bevy of material to work with this week. So this is going to be for October 9th, 2021. And yeah, it definitely feels like it now. I go outside and it actually feels mild. I do not go outside and instantly melt from either the heat or the humidity. What about down there in Ohio?
It's been in the 80s a couple times this past week.
Yeah.
I think we'll have a couple days here in the 80s for the next couple days here.
Yeah.
Hopefully that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got it's going to be a couple. We're actually getting the same over here. And then I think probably by the middle of next week, it's going to drop back down to the 70s. And probably keep going down from there until the winter. But again, this is Georgia. And, you know, our weather is just a 12-sided die of bullshit. So this week, what are we going to be talking about? Well, there was a certain data document leak that happened this week. And, it pretty much shows that, the rich and powerful of the world really are a bunch of money-hiding scumbags. We'll be telling you about it. Also, we'll have some NASCAR news. And some news about the indigenous in Australia, specifically some much needed land that had been denied them is given back to them after far too many years. Trials pertaining to the opioid crisis are ongoing, and the site is now being set from companies to, well, the other part of that equation. You'll find out which one. Infamous, notoriously bullshit abortion law in Texas is now, well, it for like a shining moment in the ether, it looks like it was going to stop, and then it didn't. We'll tell you about that. You noticed that few hours that earlier this week when Facebook didn't work? It all reminded us two things. One, that far too many people unfortunately have to rely on a company like Facebook for their infrastructure and basic meeting up. And two, life without Facebook, if you're among the privileged few, is actually not that bad. We also got some labor disputes. Famous Star Trek actor is actually going to space. We got more space film shenanigans. And, of course, a buttload of trailers and entertainment talk to talk about. All this and more on this week's episode of Let's Weekend. So, start us off as we always do. Let's start off with what we have been doing this week. Chris, other than the fact that the weather has been relatively mild or upper mild in Ohio, what have you been doing?
I've had a couple of days off here, so
yeah,
it has been pretty nice to just kind of relax for once.
Yeah, because I know you've been working some serious hours over the at least the last week.
I had a good stretch where I was doing 7 out of 8 days,
mm-hmm.
and all kind of full shifts, so that was
not very fun. Yeah, I've done that myself. It is not. It is. It should be a crime. But yeah. Welcome to America.
That's not great, but managed to get some time off here, so I've been able to watch some stuff I've been slacking on. Mm-hmm. Particularly, I've finished up Marvel's What If.
Oh, nice.
Which ends in a pretty nice way. The way of tying it all together and sending it off in a nice way. Hopefully, with some interesting, I don't know, ways of affecting maybe the mainline MCU. I don't know, but it was pretty nice to see that. I did get a chance to watch at least one of the Halloween specials they put up on Disney Plus. There's the Muppets Haunted Mansion.
Yeah, featuring my favorite. Featuring my favorite ride in Disney World. Yeah.
Yeah, sort of. It's centers around Gonzo getting challenged to go through this haunted mansion that conveniently has lots of Muppets in it. A lot of them Halloween themed, some that are like there's a lot of cameos, and some of which that you can definitely tell are based on the way they're presented, you know, due to the pandemic.
Yeah. Also, I'm pretty sure this was the last thing that Ed Asner was in, isn't it?
Seems like it, probably.
Yeah.
There's a bust of a number of actors, like Jeff Keighley. There's, I forget who the other ones are that are on that. Was Pat Sajak is in there?
Yeah, I think Craig Robinson, Justin Machado, Sky Jackson. Yeah.
Yeah. They do show a number of ghosts, which is where Ed Asner shows up, Alfonso Ribeiro. They do have a few songs throughout it. It's maybe like 50 minutes long, so it's nothing too intensive on the time front. So it kind of just moves along pretty quickly, but has a few musical numbers in there. And, you know, has a nice little story to it for the Muppets.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the Haunted Mansion itself has a couple of songs in it, so I'm not surprised.
Yeah, so that was pretty nice to see. I was hoping I had some time to do the Lego Star Wars special they have, but I haven't gotten to that yet. But did start Squid Games.
Ah, that's on Netflix. That's the one everybody's talking about right now.
Yeah.
And I really need to watch that. Eventually
their biggest show yet.
And I really need to watch it, too.
Yeah. It's an interesting show. So the irony is the way that the thing has been talked about is that it's kind of derivative of various kind of Battle Royale stuff. I saw a timeline that kind of explains sort of the way it sounds, the way, the way this whole thing sounds, is that you go from the original Battle Royale movie to PUBG, to Fortnite, to Fall Guys, to Squid Games.
Which is, weirdly enough, not terribly inaccurate as far as an arc goes. Because, like, yeah, tell everyone what, like, the essential premise of the show is.
Yeah, so it essentially seems to deal with people that are sort of down on their luck, financially speaking. People have gotten themselves into amazing amounts of debt that they have not been able to sort of rectify for whatever means they have, and eventually run into somebody that like innocently kind of challenges them to a game. It's one essentially like you have these folded pieces of paper that you kind of throw on the ground to try to flip the other person's paper thing. I guess if you get that, you win like 100,000 won. This is a Korean show, South Korean show. So there's dub options. You can watch, you know, the original audio with subtitles, all that kind of stuff, if you want. And so, yeah, it's based on that. So, 100,000 is a notable amount of money. I'm gonna look it up real quick. What it is?
It's like, if I'm remembering correctly, it's something like something to the tune of like the equivalence of like 800,000 something dollars.
No, it's about like $84 for that. So. But it's sort of a test, I guess, because they get this weird business card with a number, phone number on it.
Yeah.
That they call if they're interested in more games. to potentially win more money.
Yeah.
And so if they call the number and, you know, give their name and all that, they eventually get picked up in this van that then gases them and takes them to a secure location where they all awake and find out they are sort of in this weird facility, like a warehouse kind of thing, that I think the initial count is like 456.
Yeah.
And they, you know, initially like introduce a handful of characters through various means that they have, the relations they have to other people and whatnot.
Yeah.
And so they start their first game as they are not going to find out sort of how much money they're potentially able to win until after that first game, which ends up being red light, green light.
Yeah.
With this creepy ass giant doll that essentially is like looking at this tree, calling out green light and calling out red light and looking behind her to see if any movements, to analyze for any movements. Mm-hmm. And if they are caught, they are eliminated. As in like a sniper shot. As you see sort of a number of holes in the wall behind it.
Yep.
And you can imagine where it goes from there.
Yeah.
They do throw some curveballs into the, at least I've only watched two episodes so far. So they've thrown some curveballs already, and it's like nine episodes, I think. Most of the episodes are in the 50-minute range or so. So it's a fairly lengthy show, but it's been pretty good so far. I'm looking forward to watching some more of that and seeing where it all goes. And I think they're already talking about a season two already. And the interesting thing is that the project started many years ago, like 8 years ago, something like that.
I think it was like a decade, actually. The apparently the guy who, the original creator, he came up with the idea like a decade ago, when he spent a good 10 years trying to get the thing greenlit.
Yeah, something like that. Even sold the laptop he used to make or write down his, you know, plot and all that. Eventually got greenlit on Netflix and now has the biggest show in the world. So yeah, definitely a good reason to persist even if your ideas are not getting greenlit, because 10 years is a big change. Netflix wasn't streaming 10 years ago. Yeah, so that's seems like an excellent show so far.
Yeah. Also, I don't know if you've noticed, but all of this, like, all of this media that started coming out of about, you know, class conflict and shit, and it's all coming out of, like, South Korea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to paint a picture of South Korea for you, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's like a lot of other places.
Oh, yeah. But gaming-wise, I guess, what have you been doing?
So I got the new Nintendo Switch OLED edition, which seems pretty nice so far. The initial setup took a bit because the transfer process takes a little while. And I was initially having issues just getting it onto my network because I was looking at the wrong password for it. I'm getting super mad, like, you know, wondering if, like, the network card for this thing was busted or whatever. And I realized, oh, wait, I'm entering the wrong password because I'm an idiot. But yeah, I got it all transferred over, then realized, oh, yeah, there's the Animal Crossing bullshit.
Yeah.
With their saves. So I had to go back to my original Switch, log in with my account, because once you do the transfer process, if you do the full thing, it'll essentially wipe out all the users and leave like a generic one. With that, you would have, I had to log in, go into the eShop, re-download the game. I sort of double-checked that the save was still there, which it was, and sort of relinked it to this new user. Then downloaded the transfer tool they have on the eShop as well. And also downloaded that on the new Switch and then transferred it over from there. So once that was done, then I was pretty much done. Then I traded that in for $260 to GameStop for a launch Switch, which is a great value. Only losing $40 on that. Essentially being $90 short of the Switch OLED. As they were doing this whole bonus thing, like up to $50 extra if you're a pro member for GameStop. And you get those. So that was pretty nice for that. But yeah, played Metroid Dread. I pre-ordered that, so I got that. And that seems to be pretty good so far. It's very much like Samus Returns on the 3DS. So if you played that, you at least know the sort of counter system there, which they've expanded it a little bit because you have a counter move for when you're moving, as well as the new like slide, parkour kind of slide to it. You can counter out of that as well, our whole thing. So there's some nice new things, as well as like the whole concept of the Emmy that are roaming around certain parts of the maps here that can become aware of your presence and start chasing you around. There's like two different states. There's like it's able to sense like vibration, so it's able to tell like something's moving over here, and you can kind of see the where the pings are at from where you were just at, as well as like another mode where it's actually seen you and is, you know, aggressively pursuing you. To which the exits of these areas sort of lock down until you get out of its sight and sort of get out of alert. So, some pretty neat stuff. It's a little slow to start because it's trying to go over major parts of the Metroid storylines. Mainly the concept of, you know, the Metroids and how they've been wiped out, the X-Parasite. Those have been wiped out. But then, conveniently, the Galactic Federation gets a video, seemingly of an X-Parasite that is on this mysterious planet. So they send the Emmys to go take care of it because they're virtually indestructible. But then they go offline for some reason. And then you're sent down because you're the only other being that is immune to the X-Parasites. Because of the whole Metroid vaccine, you got, fusion, I think? So, yeah, it's pretty nice so far. I'm looking forward to put some more time into that. But it has some neat boss fights. It's tough without being too tough. Because the way that you get, you know, health drops and missile drops and other stuff pretty generously is... very nice. Even in boss fights, you kind of get a healthy amount of drops for that stuff. So that's been pretty nice so far, and also just been playing some more Rocket League as I work my way through some of these challenges. They just put out the Bond cars. Like, there's the new one that's in the new movie, No Time to Die, and there's like a classic Aston Martin in there as well that you can get. But they also have a quick set of challenges for some minor cosmetic stuff, which are all pretty easy for the most part. Won't take more than like maybe 10 games to get. So, yeah, that's been pretty much it for me, Brandon. How about you?
Yeah, well, I finished, like I said, I finished Tales of Arise, like I said, last week. I have finished my review. I'm just going to have to submit it for editing. I'll have to do that tonight, but yeah, I got all that ready to go. So since I had a bunch of time on my hands, and you know, I had a PS Now subscription, I decided it was no time at the present to basically play a game I've been wanting to play for almost 10 years now, but I just either never got around to it, or other things caught my interest, or just in general, I never got around to playing it. And that is Fallout New Vegas, which is one of those games that over the years has become a massive cult success, so much so that it's now like considered to be a legit modern classic. Especially when you consider the fact that when the game originally came out, it was glitchy and buggy as all hell. So let me just real quick, Chris, have you ever played any of the Fallout games?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I guess you played 3 and 4.
3, 4, New Vegas. I've also played a little bit of 1. Just kind of wandering around until I got killed.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a lot of people's original experience of the first Fallout, because yeah, that is essentially how it is. But New Vegas. So New Vegas is a game that is canonically the fourth game in the Fallout series, but it was, because you remember in Fallout 3, it takes place largely in BC, you know, like around the East Coast.
Yeah.
Well, the original Fallout games took place on the West Coast, you know, in that area of, you know, California, Nevada, Arizona, you know. And Fallout New Vegas essentially takes place in a, well, I mean, you know this already because you played it, but it takes place in essentially the Mojave, right in that area near Hoover Dam, and not terribly far away from the Vegas Strip either. And basically it is you're playing this guy who, you're playing this individual who is a courier, working for a courier service, who's trying to deliver what ostensibly looks like a poker chip to someone in New Vegas. And then you end up getting kidnapped by this dude named Benny and these two dudes who are great cons, you know, are essentially like a nomadic band that are kind of have like a biker aesthetic to them, but they're also, you know, the motorbikes aren't really much of a thing in this universe, but there you go. And they end up shooting you in the head and burying you. Then apparently you ended up surviving somehow. A robot named Victor manages to dig you out in this little town. And then eventually you find out sort of what the overall sort of dynamic is in this particular part. So the NCR, which is the New California Republic, which if you've played the original Fallout games, you have encountered them once or twice already, is expanding. And they're expanding eastward into deeper into Nevada. And they came across the Hoover Dam, which at that point was not operational yet. But what they didn't know is that there was another group that was rising called Caesar's Legion, which is essentially a army of slavers led by a guy who calls himself Caesar and is specifically sort of based around the ideas and aesthetics of what he thought the Roman Empire was. But what they didn't realize is that there's another faction in play, and that's New Vegas, which is being governed by, apparently run by this dude named Mr. House, who nobody has ever seen for a long ass time. He just lives up in this tower. And by the time you get into the game, there's this sort of idea overall that there's fixing to be another big clash between all of these factions again, and it's going to be at Hoover Dam. And you're kind of going to end up getting in the middle of it all. And yeah, this first thing just right off the bat is this game is so much better than Fallout 3. It is not even funny. And don't get me wrong, I liked Fallout 3 when it came out. But yeah, this one does so many things better than Fallout 3 did. The writing is much better. You know, the overall exploration is better. You don't feel like you're just going through a bunch of nothing. There's always something that you find. You don't feel like you're constantly having to look for locations, because the game tends to give you these huge landmarks that you can find very easily on the horizon that immediately show you places where you need to go. You know, like you need to go to the Mojave Outpost. You got that statue of those two rangers shaking hands that you can pretty much see like a good mile out. And of course, if you ever need to know where New Vegas is, I mean, it's always there. You can see it pretty much from space. And yeah, I mean, I'm really just kicking myself at like why I had not played it up until now. It is legitimately an amazing freaking game. And other than that, you know, I'm also still playing Mass Effect Legendary Edition, which, you know, nothing major to go there. Continuing my sort of October horror movie thing, where I'm watching another movie every week. I watched Halloween 78, you know, the original Halloween from John Carpenter, all the way back in those years with, that movie is amazing. And it's really funny watching that movie and realizing, like, how many tropes that, like, you know, the Friday the 13th movies essentially ripped off from it. And actually pretty much all the slasher movies that came after pretty much just straight up just lifted from John Carpenter's movie. Everything from, like, you know, Sex is Death to The Last Girl to, you know, the last slasher thinking he's dead, but he's actually not dead. All that shit. And it's, you know, the fact that because in really well shot and well written movie that it still holds up all these years later in spite of all the other movies trying to steal its thunder is really a major compliment to Carpenter's talent as a director. Because by all rights, this movie should have had so many tropes mined from it that it is no longer enjoyable to watch. No, the exact opposite. It is still a great movie to watch. It is also very much of its time. You know, it was the late 70s, so that is noticeable. And of course, you know, being that it's a Carpenter flick, it's got an amazing score because Carpenter basically did the score for all of his movies. So much so, I think he's probably done more music stuff film-wise than anything else he's ever done. And he's even got, like, a second career as a musician now. So, yeah. Halloween 78, see it. It's amazing. And, everything else is just, it's nice outside now. I've been able to do my, you know, daily walks now without coming home with my clothes stuck to my, you know, glued to my skin from sheer perspiration because of the humidity. It actually feels nice out there. Like, you know, it's fit for humans to actually live in. So, yeah, that's awesome. It's one of the reasons I love this time of year. The frickin' weather is just amazing. So you got anything you want to add before we move on?
Nope.
No? Okay. Well then, with that, it is now time to move on to every favorite part of the show, Brandon's Random Factoid. And so, Chris, I want to ask you, have you ever had any family that was ever in the military?
Yeah, a bunch of people.
Yeah, like what? Like Army, Navy, Air Force?
My grandfather was in the Air Force during the Korean War.
Uh-huh.
And various cousins and such in, like, mostly the Army.
Yeah. My great-granddad was actually in the Navy in World War II. He fought at Iwo Jima. But if there's one, so have you ever had, like, your family tell you, like, war stories? Has that ever happened? Like, is that like, hey, tell me a war story. Did that ever happen?
Nope.
Yeah. Not me really either. Cause, weirdly enough, that kind of thing just didn't interest me when I was a kid, believe it or not. But, Then I got older, and, you know, I had some friends who went off and joined the military. I got a buddy from high school who went into the Navy, a guy who went into the Air Force, another guy who had the as a medic, and then another one who went and ended up becoming a Marine. And let me tell you, there's one thing about all four of them I can tell you that they told me about that they have in common. And it's alcohol shenanigans. Because if there is one thing that people in the military love to do, it's to get hammered. And if there's one thing they like doing more than that, it's finding creative ways to get hammered. Because obviously, when you're out at sea or you're out on, you know, in the field or, you know, you're doing R&R or whatever, you know, there's not always, you know, a store or a place where you can get some easy alcohol, right? Nope. No, obviously not. But, you know, still a lot of folks still gotta get that fix, right? So there are like a whole bunch of stories of like people of my buddies who were in the Army, like, you know, being out in Afghanistan and they needed to. They were like, you know, it was like a dude recently, his wife had, you know, had given the news that she'd had a baby and they wanted to celebrate, but they didn't have any liquor. So they ended up making, you know, they didn't have like any really good liquor to make. So they ended up making something called jungle juice, which is where you basically just take a bunch of like candy that you can find. There's like a bunch of different recipes, but basically it's a bootlegged alcohol drink. They used it that they put like a shit ton of like fruit and candy and sugar, you know, raisins. And then, they had a habit ferment for a while. And they ended up put like, and the thing is, they didn't have like a container or anything. They had like a garbage can, like a 30-gallon garbage can that they put the shit in. And he was like, yeah, it didn't taste great, but it definitely worked, and you ended up seeing just a shit ton of Marines running around in the desert naked. But this got me, you know, interested in the idea of, you know, soldiers in the field coming up with, you know, alcohol that they had to sort of make on the fly. And that's when I found out this week's tidbit for random factoid. Chris, have you ever heard of something called torpedo juice?
Nope.
Okay, now, originally from the name torpedo, pee-related or something. No, it's not pee-related, but it might be just as foul. Okay, so World War II. Got a bunch of Americans, Navy, they're on ships, submarines, out at sea. You got to do something to unwind, and, well, alcohol is one of those best ways to unwind, at least, you know, culturally. But there ain't a whole lot of alcohol to go around. In fact, there's almost no alcohol to go around. Well, at least not the kind that you would immediately consider drinking. So, here's what they did. You see, back in the old days, the torpedoes that the United States Navy used were powered by 180-proof grain alcohol. Well, it was a fuel that included 180-proof grain alcohol. Now, the thing is, as we know from Prohibition, when the U.S. government puts alcohol in something, it usually kind of knows that people are going to try and drink it, so it usually ends up adding shit that they think will actually keep people from drinking it, like, say, poisonous additives, shall we say. So stuff like croton oil, or, you know, shit like that. Let's just say when you need a drink and you're that freaking desperate, you'll do just about anything. And so what happened is a bunch of sailors came up with this idea of taking the alcohol out of those motors, stilling it. They would put it through a stilling process that was supposed to separate the alcohol from the poisonous additives. They would mix it with pineapple juice, and then they would mix it all together and then drink. Now, this, even by the fact that you're, you know, drinking fuel, is obviously kind of a risk in and of itself. But it goes a little bit further than that. See, the alcohol that is any kind of alcohol, it was ethyl alcohol, stuff that was denatured with a 5 to 10% pink leg mixture, which is basically a blend of dye, methanol, and some other stuff. Now, methanol, for those who don't know, it causes blindness when you ingest it, and it cannot be made non-poisonous. Now, supposedly, if you filtered the fuel mix through a loaf of bread, you could get rid of most of the methanol. But the problem was, is, you know, remember, you're drinking this stuff not just to drink, but also to get hammered. And on top of getting the intoxication and the subsequent hangover, you would also end up getting some mild or severe reactions. Things like, painful cramps, internal bleeding, and what they described as, quote, a violent emptying of the bowels. So, eventually, what happened is they ended up putting croton oil into this shit, and the sailors came up with the idea of devising stills to slowly separate the alcohol from the poison, which, for those you don't know, alcohol actually evaporates at a lower temperature than croton oil, which meant that if you were able to do it just right, you could manage to get all the alcohol and leave the poison behind. Now, if you're thinking about this, you're like, okay, so what eventually happened to this? Well, eventually, in 1943, the Navy introduced the Mark 18 torpedo, which was completely electric powered, which means no fuel was needed. Now, that meant that the torpedo juice essentially ended with it. However, there are still limited qualities of denatured alcohol, which were and are still required by the electricians, mates, and interior communication electricians on board ship for the purpose of cleaning slip rings, commutators, and carbon brushes on a wide variety of equipment, which means that they're still technically making torpedo juice on ships. They're just not torpedo-related anymore. And of course, tune in another time when I'll tell you how people in the Vietnam War used to chew pieces of C4 so they could get high. And that was yet another installment of Brandon's Random Factoid. Yeah. See, that's one of the reasons why I never went into the Army. I respect my liver. I say, even though I drink like once a week, but whatever. Okay, so with that out of the way, it is now time to move on to the show proper, and as always with the show proper, we have to start off with the assholes of the week. And our first major assholes of the week are all the individuals, and there were a lot of them, that were leaked in a series of financial documents that the world has now come to call the Pandora Papers, that exposed offshore dealings of hundreds of the world's global elite, including politicians, financiers, celebrities, you name it.
Yep. Nearly 12 million documents obtained by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Say there's more than 330 politicians from nearly 100 countries.
Mm-hmm.
Just from the initial reporting on this, it doesn't seem like there's any huge names on there. But there are, let's see, shows wealthy individuals from all over the world. Mm-hmm. Parking money in Caribbean tax havens, hiding assets in foreign trusts, and shielding their wealth in opaque Panamanian corporations.
Mm-hmm.
12 sitting heads of state implicated in the Pandora Papers, most are from low or middle income countries.
Mm-hmm.
As are many other politicians and other figures.
Mm.
Stuff like Brazil, Ivory Coast, Gabon, India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka are among the countries on the list.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's unfortunately not going to be any super huge names that we would know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like there's the current Kenyan president, Uhuru Kenyatta, along with six members of his family is implicated in the papers.
Mm-hmm.
They control a network of offshore companies and foundations in Panama and mm-hmm. the British Virgin Islands worth more than $30 million.
Mm-hmm.
Azerbaijani president Ilham Aliyev's family mm-hmm. is alleged to have been involved in property deals in Britain worth hundreds of millions of dollars. His son was just 11 years old when he became the shareholder in a company based in the British Virgin Islands that purchased a building in the upscale London neighborhood of Mayfair for $49 million.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the documents link Chilean President Sebastian Piñera,
mm-hmm.
Who made a fortune in the credit card business before entering politics, to more than $100 million parked in shell companies in the British Virgin, mm-hmm. Virgin Islands. Yeah, the former head of the Philippines Presidential Commission on Good Government is on the list as well.
Mm.
So yeah, bunch of names. Doesn't seem like anything that's going to make big waves, at least right now, in, you know, the major company countries in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, it seems like they still got maybe some more work to do to look through it.
Mm. Yeah. So I guess really it's not so much that people are surprised about this. It's, I guess, just the extent of it that really shocked people.
Yeah, and that's, you know, this stuff leaked to show
mm-hmm.
exactly who is doing all of this stuff.
Yeah. And then here's our other major asshole of the week, the Catholic Church of France, which, according to a new report, abused about 333,000 children, approximately, according to a new report. Wow.
Yeah, that is over the past 70 years, since mm-hmm. about 1950. Yeah, according to a report released Tuesday that represents the country's first major accounting of the worldwide phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Includes abuses committed by some 3,000 priests and other people involved in the church, wrongdoing that Catholic authorities covered up over decades in a systemic manner.
Mm.
According to the president of the commission that issued the report, the head of the French Bishops Conference asked for forgiveness from the victims,
mm.
about 80% of whom were boys. The bishops are meeting Tuesday to discuss next steps.
Mm.
The independent commission urges the church to take strong action, denouncing faults in silence.
Mm-hmm.
It also called on the Catholic Church to help compensate the victims, notably cases that are too old to prosecute by the courts.
Mm.
Yeah, and obviously these kids suffered very serious consequences as a result. About 60% of men and women who were sexually abused encounter major problems in their emotional or sexual life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 2,500-page document.
Yeah. Yeah, and this goes back how long?
Since the 50s.
Yeah. Damn. So basically shortly after the end of World War II to now. Yeah.
Damn. Damn.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we... okay, so here's the thing. France has this very complicated history with the Catholic Church. As anybody who, you know, knows or studies French history does. French culture is very Catholic. You know, at least, you know, as far as Catholic influence, I should say. But at the same time, French culture also has a strong bit of anti-clericalism that goes back, you know, centuries. You know, I mean, you can go as far back as the French Revolution up to now. And yeah, this is just going to further that divide, really. And rightfully so. I mean, Jesus, that's a lot of kids. Whew.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure how that would compare to, like, the diocese in the U.S. I mean, because, you know, the U.S. obviously is bigger than France is. But, yeah, just damn. Anyway, just we're going to go ahead and go off to Heroes of the Week because I do not want to hang too much on that. That is a very troubling subject in and of itself. Unfortunately, this week we do have some heroes to talk about. The first hero of this week is Bubba Wallace, who This week became only the second African-American driver in NASCAR history to win a Cup Series.
Yeah, a Cup Series race.
Race, yeah.
This was a race that was interrupted by rain.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, and he managed to be in the lead when they ended up calling it.
Yeah.
Which is great for him.
Yeah.
He's been through a lot, and I believe the last time that a black driver won a NASCAR Cup Series race was in, like, 1963.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm sure that was a lot of fun back then.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, no kidding.
Yep. So, yeah, that is great news for him.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he's coming near the end of the season,
mm-hmm.
so he's not. So they're doing the playoff stuff, and mm-hmm. he's technically not in it, so it doesn't really help him all that much, but, you know, might help him going into the next season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, good on him. Holy crap. Yeah, he ended up winning at Talladega. I mean, that's a big freaking deal.
Yep.
But, yeah, next up. Australia. The government of Australia is officially returning 4 national parks and a series of other lands to the indigenous Australian population.
Yep, this is definitely a big deal. Signed last month between members of the Eastern Kuku-Yalanji community and the mm-hmm. government. It means 4 national parks are returned to the traditional owners of the land.
Mm-hmm.
There includes the Daintree National Park.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Which is also considered the world's oldest tropical rainforest, as well as these 3 other parks we jointly managed for a time mm-hmm. by the Queensland government and the Kuku-Yalanji
mm-hmm.
Gives the tribe management over their land and culture.
Mm.
They're returning more than 160,000 hectares or almost 400,000 acres
mm-hmm.
in Cape York in Northern Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's and that Daintree National Park is a UNESCO World Heritage Site
mm-hmm.
that is estimated to be around 130 million years old.
Mm. Yeah, that and I'm glad the Australia is stepping up and giving this land back to the indigenous population because the Aboriginal treated very well by the Australian government in ever.
Yeah.
This is kind of a big, because I remember so do you remember that band Midnight Oil? They had that song Beds Are Burning.
I don't think so.
Okay, it's fine. I'll just explain it. They had this huge song called Beds Are Burning that was an international hit. It was the one huge hit they had outside of Australia and the UK. And it was specifically about some of the land that they're actually giving back now, because some of it was used for nuclear testing. Or at least missile testing, not necessarily nuclear missile testing. And that band, when the Olympics went to Australia in 2000, performed that song there, and all of them were wearing these t-shirts that said sorry on them, because it had been a good almost 13-15 years since they'd released that song, and the government still hadn't given the land back. Yeah, so this is a big deal. And finally, our last year week is the New York Public Library System, which is eliminating all late fees effective immediately.
Yep. They will not charge fines on overdue materials, and all library card holders have had their accounts cleared of any prior late fees or fines,
mm-hmm.
including replacement fees for lost materials. They call this a change intended to level the playing field for all library patrons, encourage use of library resources.
Yeah.
I hope this ends up spreading. Yeah. It seems like the Boston Public Library system is committed to eliminating all late fees.
Yeah.
after previously nixing overdue fees for miners.
Mm-hmm.
And there are others that have pledged similar kinds of things. But yeah, the president of the New York Public Library says fines are an antiquated and effective way to encourage patrons to return their books.
Yeah.
For those who can afford the fines, they are barely an incentive.
Yeah. And those who can't afford fines, they'll usually just wait until, you know, the yearly grace period that all libraries have.
For those who can't afford the fines, disproportionately low-income New Yorkers, mm-hmm. they become a real barrier to access that we can no longer accept.
Yeah.
As a step towards a more equitable society with more New Yorkers reading and using libraries, we are proud to make it happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely hope they end up doing that down here in Georgia. Of course, they won't, but I can hope.
It's one of those things, even if it's a few dollars, it's kind of a shame to it.
Yeah.
And all that kind of stuff.
Well, for some people, a few dollars, you know, can be a life or death situation. So.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So, with that, it is time now to move on from the show proper, the proper show proper. And the first story we've got is that the opioid crisis trials are continuing, and now the sites are being set from the pill makers to the pill pushers, specifically the major pharmacy chains, CVS, Walgreens, Walmart.
Giant Eagle.
Mm-hmm.
The companies say they did nothing wrong in the way they dispensed highly addictive pain pills, but the jury trial now getting underway could expose them to billions of dollars in liability and huge risk to their reputations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they argue that the companies earned billions of dollars dispensing opioids while often failing to implement adequate safety and monitoring systems for high-risk medications.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, been a problem since the 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
These pharmacies didn't really start trying to screen even semi-effectively until after they'd already been slapped on the wrist.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's that document, pharmacist, which is about, you know, a pharmacist whose son, you know, overdosed on heroin, and he ended up he did some research, and he ended up exposing, like, a huge pill pusher ring involving doctors and pharmacies all over his state. So yeah, some of the pharmacies definitely have some responsibility in this.
Yeah, and this initial trial is starting here in Cleveland, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Involving just two Ohio counties, Lake and Trumbull. But it's very much going to be viewed as a bellwether test case.
Mm-hmm.
They face more than 3,300 similar lawsuits filed by the local and state governments nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
If they're found liable, they could be required to pay billions of dollars to help governments cover the cost of easing an opioid epidemic that's killed hundreds of thousands of Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, like I said, they definitely share some of the blame. Because some of those pharmacies were extremely, extremely irresponsible with pushing out OxyContin and fentanyl and shit like that.
Yep.
But, yeah, so moving on from there, the ongoing abortion law in Texas is in that we recently had a bit of a blip. A federal judge had temporarily blocked the new abortion law, which lasted for, like a day? And then a higher court struck down that ruling.
Yeah. The federal judge blocked the enforcement of that law on the 6th, which is Wednesday. So said that from the moment SB 8 went into effect last month, women have been unlawfully prevented from exercising control over their lives in ways that are protected by the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
He added, other courts may find a way to avoid this conclusion. Is theirs to decide? This court will not sanction one more day of this offensive deprivation of such an important right.
Mm.
And so the Attorney General Merrick Garland celebrated this.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, then it went to the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals.
Mm-hmm.
Struck down that ruling.
Yeah.
The Department of Justice now has until October 12th to reply to the ruling.
Yeah.
The ban remains in effect until then.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
It said until October 12th.
Yeah.
Let's see. That's Tuesday, so.
Yeah.
We'll see where that goes.
Yep.
Yeah, so let's see. And now for probably the other big, massive story that happened this week, which is some of y'all probably woke up one morning and you looked at social media and you found out, holy shit, Facebook isn't working. Yeah, Monday, for much of Monday, Facebook and its various associated services were out globally. Facebook, Instagram,
WhatsApp, Oculus.
Yeah, all of them just kaput.
Yeah.
And of course, the reason this was also kind of timing, because, you know, there had been that whistleblower that came forward around that same time period. And she was like giving a statement at a congressional hearing as it was happening.
Yeah, though this seemed to be...
No, it was a DNS issue.
Yeah, something like that, that kind of just escalated big time.
Yeah.
As they say here, the outage also whacked Facebook's own internal systems and tools that it relies on for daily operations.
Yeah, that was the other issue. A lot of them couldn't even get into the building because their ID cards were specifically linked to the Facebook servers.
Yeah, and even the people that, you know, work in their IT and all that couldn't get in because it was all down.
Yeah.
They had to physically go to the place where their servers were at to reset things manually.
Mm-hmm. Which, man, that had to be a pain in the ass.
So, them having to get, you know, chainsaws to cut locks and all that kind of stuff to get there. Yeah, so that's, as I say here, outage struck around 11:40 a.m. Eastern time and was back about 6:30 p.m. Eastern time. Configuration changes on the backbone routers that coordinate network traffic between our data centers went down, blocking their ability to communicate and setting off the cascade of network failures. And it suggests that the problem arose between Facebook and the Border Gateway Protocol, a vital tool underlying the internet. Yeah, it's sort of similar to like a GPS system for the internet. When a company can't use the gateway protocol, it's as if their online domains simply don't exist. That didn't stop web pages, searches, and messages from looking for Facebook properties. That in turn led to other problems. And many organizations saw their network disruptions and slowness thanks to billions of devices constantly asking for the current coordinates of Facebook.com, Instagram.com, and WhatsApp.com. It came as Facebook, had the whole testifying stuff going on at the Senate subcommittee meeting. Yeah, they also stressed that there's no evidence that user data was compromised as a result of the downtime. Hey, if your business relied on Instagram, Facebook, WhatsApp, whatever.
Yeah, you were screwed.
And a number of countries were...
There are countries who rely on Facebook's infrastructure for some essential services.
Yeah, essentially treat like WhatsApp as like native messaging services that we have on our phones.
And I mean, there's also like
disappeared for them.
Yeah, and there was also there. I mean, there's also like groups that are like you know, support groups and stuff that rely on Facebook that were basically cut off from each other. You know, so on the one hand, you know, I totally get all. Oh yeah, life is definitely better without Facebook, because I'll admit, not having that to worry about is like a huge relief. You know, if you're among the privileged few. But if you're part of a group where, you know, like we mentioned, your country relies on its infrastructure, or you're in like a mental health support group and you need these connections to, you know, be able to function during the day. Yeah, you were in a serious spot for a while there. Yeah. And of course, Twitter had to be kind of smug about it, and they put out, it's like, hello, everybody in the world.
Yeah, they had their biggest active audience during that time frame.
Yeah, and I believe Zuckerberg lost a good $7 billion.
Oh, yeah, that's...
Yeah, their Facebook's stock, I don't want to say it tanked, but it definitely went down significantly during the outage. And, I mean, it was kind of a 1-2 punch, too, because, again, on top of the outage, you had that whistleblower who was giving her statement to the Congressional Committee as it was happening. So Facebook was already having to deal with bad press, and this just made it worse.
Yep.
But next up, we got a bit of a workers' union and solidarity. All over the United States, Kellogg's U.S. cereal plant workers went on strike over lost benefits and other threats.
Yeah, this involves about 1,400 workers that have gone on strike. Includes plants in Omaha, Nebraska, Battle Creek, Michigan, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and Memphis, Tennessee. The union and Kellogg's have been in an impasse at the bargaining table for more than a year.
Yep.
Dispute involves an assortment of pay and benefit issues, such as the loss of premium health care, holiday and vacation pay, and reduced retirement benefits.
That's right.
There's also sort of the threat of sending additional jobs to Mexico if the workers do not accept their, you know, proposals.
Yep.
As well, which just doesn't... It's like, if you're going to do that, you can do it at any time.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily rely on just accepting these ridiculous offers.
Well, the fact that they actually put that threat out there is a very good indicator of what their mindset is towards their employees.
Yeah.
It they basically see them as replaceable, if not expendable.
Yeah, and they put out a weird fact saying that their employees made an average of $120,000 a year last year. It's like, I assume that includes the executives and such that get paid quite well.
Oh, yeah.
So, it's like, okay, that's average. What about median? Show you much closer to what the average person gets.
Yeah. But you're starting to notice, you're starting to hear more stories like these coming about now. Like, that we're sort of living in the Renaissance States now and starting to see that, you know, they're happening a bit more frequently than they were really just 6 years ago.
Yeah, the pandemic has made it much easier to see the cracks in the systems.
Yeah.
And seeing how much these huge companies rely on the so-called unskilled labor to hire.
And also how behind the United States kind of is socioeconomically. As far as, like, workers' rights and benefits and entitlements and stuff go.
Oh, yeah, just ask anybody who lives in Europe about how much, you know, vacation time they get and sick days and that kind of stuff.
There's
maternity and paternity leave and all that.
The country of Belgium is fixing to go on a 4-day work week. Just imagine that. And it's only going to spread from there.
Yeah.
But, next up, in more American news, trailblazing women in U.S. history will be featured on quarters for the next 4 years. So you've got, you know, the ones that you're going to think of. You're going to, you know, Harriet Tubman, Susan Anthony, Amelia Earhart.
Yeah, the ones they've announced so far have, let's see, poet Maya Angelou, astronaut Sally Ride, actress Anna May Wong. Suffragist and politician Nina Otero Warren.
Yep.
Wilma Mankiller, the first female principal chief of Cherokee Nation.
Yep.
Those are sort of the first years thing. You remember like the early 2000s where they're doing the state quarters? It's going to be something similar where I guess it's going to be, let's see, 4 years, five each, about 20 different women as they rotate in and out. Yeah, that's exciting to see. Still waiting on the $20 bill thing.
Yeah.
Harry Tubman.
Still supposed to be in the works.
And unfortunately, the last guy delayed it as much as he could.
Because he was a prick. But yeah. All right, so awesome. Awesome to hear. Next up, William Shatner is actually going to space next week on Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin. And yep. He's just been telling everybody he possibly can.
It's a big name. It's somebody that Bezos can get out there.
Yeah. Somebody who was on a show that was in space before humans, before Americans actually had gone to the moon.
Yeah.
So.
And he is 90 years old.
Yeah. Which, you gotta admit, considering his age, he does not look it. I mean, granted, he looks kind of red and bloated because he drinks a lot because he's Shatner, but.
Yeah.
But, for a 90-year-old man, he looks really good.
Yeah, it's going to be launching October 12th, so Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
He is going to be launching, let's see, with as part of a four-person crew. Includes Planet mm-hmm. Labs co-founder Chris Boschwiesen, Medidata co-founder Glenn DeVries,
mm.
and Blue Origin refers to as both customer and astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, the last member is Blue Origin executive Audrey Powers,
mm-hmm.
former NASA flight controller and engineer who oversees the New Shepard program's flight operations.
Mm.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. Speaking of space, there's a Russian actor right now on the International Space Station as we speak because he's filming portions of a movie up there.
Yep. Yulia Parasild.
Mm-hmm.
His next movie has limited gravity and is constantly traveling the set for his next movie. Yeah, that is because he's in the ISS now
mm-hmm.
As of Tuesday morning, along with fellow crew members of the Soyuz MS-19 spacecraft
mm-hmm.
with veteran Roscosmos cosmonaut Anton Shkaplerov and film producer Klim Shipenko.
Mm.
They're going to film portions of a movie called The Challenge. It'll be the first feature-length fiction movie shot in space.
Mm-hmm.
We reportedly tell the story of a Russian doctor who rushed to save the life of a cosmonaut aboard the ISS.
Mm. That means Russia is literally the first country to film a movie in space.
Yeah.
Yeah. So look for the space race to be kick-started again by the movie industry very soon. next up, in another bit of organized labor, IATSE, that's the International Association of Theatrical, what is it?
Stage Employees?
Theatrical Stage Employees, that's right. International Association of Theatrical Stage Employees. International Alliance, sorry. Voted this week to authorize a strike if the studios don't make a good offer.
Yep, they are sort of in negotiations, but some 60,000 workers that have voted overwhelmingly to authorize a strike if needed,
mm-hmm.
which would impact pretty much all of Hollywood.
Yeah, we're pretty much going to see a sort of repeat. If this happens, you'll basically see a repeat of the Writers Guild strike that happened.
Though this is much bigger than that.
Well, it'd be, yeah, something that, but much bigger.
Yeah, because that's just the writers weren't involved, yeah. But this is...
This would grind much, the entire industry to a halt, basically.
Yeah, basically all the behind-the-scenes crew.
Yeah.
For the most part.
The light people, the sound people, the key grips, all of them. On yep. strike, out up front, picket signs. Yeah.
And they've got major support from various actors
yeah.
throughout the throughout Hollywood, as well as politicians and legislators of all kinds. So
yeah.
Yeah. The AMPTP, the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers,
mm-hmm.
has been in... discussions over a deal,
mm-hmm.
Saying the producers' organization remains committed to reaching an agreement mm-hmm. that will keep the industry working. We deeply value our IATSC crew members and are committed to working with them to avoid shutting down the industry at such a pivotal time.
Yeah.
Since the industry is still recovering from the economic fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they had also wrote that they had listened to the demands and offered a package including, quote, substantial improvements in rest periods, increases in wages and benefits, increases in minimum rates for specific job categories, and more. Let's see. And after the votes, they also wrote that a deal, quote, can be made at the bargaining table, but it will require both parties working together in good faith with a willingness to compromise and to explore new solutions to resolve the open issues.
Mm.
Seems like them begging for them to take a deal of some kind.
Yeah. Once again, another story of organized labor sort of showing its muscle. Again, you wouldn't see a story like this with this frequency 6 years ago. Because, and here's the thing. You don't screw around with unions in the film business. they will throw down if they have to.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll see how that goes. I know that, you know, some of the, like, indie productions have started, you know, making some deals with the Yahtzee people if a strike does happen. Like, I know the folks who work at the Young Turks, they recently reached a deal with them. So, we'll see how this goes. Next up, and of course, we're now in the entertainment show, so... next up, WandaVision spinoff starring Katherine Hahn is in the works for Disney Plus. Well, I mean, she was like one of the draws of that show, so.
Yeah, and introduced an interesting character of Agatha Harkness.
Mm-hmm.
He's sort of, I guess the series is going to be something of a dark comedy.
Oh, yeah.
No real details on the plot, but that'd be an interesting thing to bring to the MCU.
It couldn't be anything but a dark comedy with that character.
Yeah. But yeah, that's neat to see.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you gotta give Disney credit. They listen to the fans somewhat and realize, you know, what they want.
Just everything.
Mm-hmm. But next up, the Netflix, they are ordering a spinoff of That 70s Show called That 90s Show. By the way, in case you're wondering, was a spinoff of That 70s Show that was called That 80s Show. It was shit.
It wasn't like a direct spinoff. It was just...
Yeah, it was barely related. Yeah. This one, they're actually like bringing back people from the original show for it.
Yeah, Kurtwood Smith and Deborah Jo Rupp.
Yep.
To be Red and Kitty again.
Yeah, grandparents this time instead of just parents.
Yeah, they've ordered 10 episodes, multicam sitcom like the original.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be set in 1995, and Leia Forman, daughter of Eric and Donna, mm-hmm. is visiting her grandparents for the summer, where she bonds with a new generation of Point Place, Wisconsin kids.
Yeah.
Under the watchful eye of Kitty and Red.
Yeah.
Like all the same creators and such that worked on the original show are coming back
mm-hmm.
For the most part. So that'd be interesting to see.
Yeah.
Danny Masterson's probably not going to be there at all.
No, because he's a creep and he needs to stay as far away from it as possible.
Yeah.
But I guess so. Like if they said like a Topher Grace or...
I think those are the first two they've announced.
Yeah.
I haven't announced who the kid is going to be played by yet.
Nah.
But of course, she gets named after Leia.
Yeah, of course. Him, because, I mean, well, you watch the show, so.
Yeah, he gets obsessed with Star Wars after
that. Like a lot of people did in the late 70s after that movie came out.
Yep. Even had, like, the Millennium Falcon, like, case.
Yeah, the original action figure line with the Millennium Falcon case that they came in. Well, that you could put them in. So we'll see that. We also have news that Trek Discovery is getting a fourth season. Well, we knew that it was getting a fourth season, but it's going to be beginning November 18th.
Yep. And there's a trailer link at the bottom if you want to see it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, continues all that stuff. I haven't seen it yet, but I'll probably try and check it out at some point here.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's good to see more of that.
Yeah. And now we got some trailers. First, we got a trailer for Resident Evil, Welcome to Raccoon City, that was divisive, to say the least.
Yeah, but also the original movie series was not exactly a well-liked thing.
No, it wasn't. It made all the money really in the world, but it didn't...
Yeah, like, it progressively made more money with each movie.
Yeah.
But this one's trying to be more faithful.
Yeah.
Go to the original mansion.
Mm-hmm.
They even go directly to show, like, the iconic thing of the zombie that's eating somebody and turns around.
Yep, the very first Resident Evil game. That particular scene made a lot of young gamers crap their pants. I am not going to lie.
Yep. They introduced, like, Claire and Chris.
Mm-hmm.
I think Claire being, like, a conspiracy nut, trying to break the case of what's going on with Umbrella and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Chris being his dumb self.
Yeah.
All that. People are shitting on it, but it's like, what would you expect out of this ridiculous franchise?
Yeah.
Especially when they're trying to be faithful.
Like, the original storyline of the original Resident Evil is like B movie extraordinaire.
You know, especially if you're trying to bring additional lore that was added throughout the following games to the first movie story. Yeah.
Just consider this for a moment. The first game takes place in this creepy ass mansion that's way out in the middle of the woods, where you're playing two members of a highly militarized police force of a dinky-ass city, Raccoon City, wherein, for whatever reason, the person had this weird obsession with a bunch of weird-ass mechanical puzzles involving a bunch of different colored keys and key cards and statues and other shit. And what part of that makes you think high art?
Yeah. So, go, you got the evil corporation that's unleashed a zombie virus.
Yeah. And keep in mind, the idea of a pharmaceutical corporation being involved in some human rights abuses and some, you know, awful corporate crime, that's completely plausible. But as the series wore on, Umbrella's overall, like, you know, origins and why they did what they did became more and more ridiculous.
Yep.
I mean, and then keep in mind, you got frickin' Wesker in the middle of all of it. Remember Wesker? The guy with the shades who had, like, superhuman speed?
Yeah, and the hair.
Yeah.
Constantly turned on his people helping him.
Yeah. And yeah, he somehow still managed to get people to hire him.
Yep.
Of course this frickin' franchise doesn't make any damn sense. And of course, I don't think that the trailer helped it when it tried to use Four Non-Blondes' What's Up for the soundtrack.
Yeah.
Mostly, and that's not really their fault, it's the fact that the song became associated with a very popular internet meme.
Yeah.
Which, unfortunately, is where a lot of people of the younger generation discovered. Didn't realize it was originally a very popular alternative rock song in the early 90s.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
This movie will be out October 21st?
Mm-hmm.
November 24th.
November 24th, right.
Yeah.
Alright.
Yeah, it's like they're setting up a new franchise in the first movie, because I think this one technically covers, like, the first two games.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a lot. Cover in like a 2-hour movie.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Most movies would struggle to just do one game's worth of stuff, because that's all, you know, the shark, the giant spider, the giant snake, those weird ass bosses.
Yeah,
which I'm sure it'll go through all that kind of weird shit.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, we'll see. Well. And then next up, we got a trailer for Blade Runner Black Lotus, which definitely looked better.
Yep. That is the weird Crunchyroll and Adult Swim partnership.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That still is coming sometime this fall, but has no date.
Mm.
I guess it's all part of New York Comic Con stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Getting announced. So Adult Swim put out this trailer. Just looks to be like a potentially mm-hmm. pretty good show.
Yeah. Yeah, actually looks good. And finally, we got a trailer, Shinmu the Animation. That's right, the anime, the Shinmu anime. And, well, definitely the Shinmu anime.
Yep. Not really too much. It's just sort of a first look trailer, but that'll be out next year at some point. Probably on Adult Swim.
Mm. Oh, yeah. All right. And, yeah, I think we got a show. Don't we? Yeah, we're done.
Yep.
And once again, we managed to keep it under 2 hours. Awesome. So I would like to remind all of our listeners and invite them, if you have a question, comment, or something you want us to read on the air, you can get in contact@letsweekenders@gmail.com. That's letsweekenders@gmail.com. You got a link for you in our show notes. Also, if you wish to catch our bit of unscripted shenanigans outside of Apple Podcasts, you can catch our little bit of lunacy at TuneIn, Google Play, RSS, archive.org, or any kind of podcast aggregate you can think of. And if we're not there when you find a new one, don't worry. As soon as we find out of a new aggregator, we will almost immediately sign up on it. We are inevitable. We will eventually be on there. We will spread to all corners of the internet. There is no stopping us. So with that little bit of happy news, I'd like to thank Chris Logie for once again helping me out this week. Tune in next week. We should have a bigger crowd that time. Thanks that band season is finally over. Join us next week for yet another edition of Let's Weekend. I've been your host with the most, Brandon Perkins, and I would like to say to all of you, good night, sleep tight, and until this pandemic is over, I will continue to say, please, if you can get the vaccine, go and get it, because I would like to be able to leave my house without a mask sometime in my life.